Hey there, podcast listeners. This is Scott Weingart, and you're listening to the MCrit Podcast. This month, on the recommendation of Rom from Canada, we're going to do a segment on calcium channel blocker overdose. And essentially what we're going to deal with today is the patient who is dying in front of you after a calcium channel blocker overdose. Now, I'm not a toxicologist, but I play one in the ED and the ICU occasionally, but this is not an area of true expertise for me. So I recruited someone from the blogosphere who you should know if you don't already. His name is Leon Gusso, and he is the creator of a blog called The Poison Review. And it is one of my favorite blogs for toxicology. I highly recommend it. We're going to put a link in the show notes. Now, Leon has been practicing and teaching medical toxicology since 1992. He's board certified in emergency medicine and internal medicine. He teaches at the University of Illinois and at Cook County in Chicago. He works as a consultant with the Illinois Poison Center, and he also writes a monthly column in the Emergency Medicine News Journal. I just love Leon's blog. It's my source for all the new toxicology articles of interest. Leon has a kind of unique rating system for these articles. He grades them, but why don't I let Leon tell you about that?
Yeah, we rate things on a scale of 1 to 5 skulls, 1 skull being not worth reading for any reason, 5 skulls being pretty much an essential article that anyone with any interest in the topic should read. So far we've had 1 1-skuller, which I will not name, and recently did our first 5-skull article.
All right, so that's the voice of Leon Gusso. So Leon, we have a case for you. You got a 40-year-old gentleman come in. He's suicidal. Took a whole bunch of calcium channel blockers. You don't know exactly how many, and he does not look good. What do you do with a patient like this?
Okay, in that case, you always start with the ABCs, airway, breathing, and circulation. Make sure that the airway is secure, that the patient's oxygenating adequately. There are various so-called standard treatments that have been around for years. Many people would go to calcium. Really, experience and the literature shows that the success with those are variable, and often they're not successful. So it's certainly possible to give 30 cc's of calcium gluconate or 10 cc's of 10% calcium chloride. Most likely, it's not going to work to reverse a hypertension.
Now, you folks are going to be dealing with some past and present tense issues here. Some of my audio was recorded in real time. Some of it, like the audio you're hearing right now, is recorded later on after the interview. So just to recap, Leon has told us the first thing you start with is the ABCs. You make sure their airway's patent, make sure they're breathing okay, make sure you have some circulatory monitoring going on. You have some big bore IV access. You place the patient on oxygen. This is just standard bread and butter emergency medicine. Your first specific intervention is to administer calcium. Now, Leon said you could either give a gram of calcium chloride or you could give 3 grams of calcium gluconate. Now, just as an aside, there seems to be a lot of confusion about these two different medications and when you use which one. The deal is calcium chloride, it immediately disassociates when it hits your plasma. It has more calcium per cc than the calcium gluconate. And the deal is, each has its own advantages and disadvantages. The advantages of calcium chloride is it does not require liver metabolism. So you give it, it immediately dissociates, your calcium's there, boom, and it has a lot more calcium, as we mentioned. Calcium gluconate, on the other hand, needs liver breakdown in order to get your free calcium there. You got to give more of it. And Calcium chloride can be given as an IV push. If you try pushing calcium gluconate, the patient will get hypotensive. So it would just seem like calcium chloride's the way to go. I mean, that's quicker, you have to give less of it, more calcium, instant use by the body. Wow, it's beautiful. Except that it can actually sclerose the tissues if there's extravasation. So you don't want to give this in a crappy 22 gauge in the hand. Some people advocate for central access for calcium chloride. I don't think you need to be that careful, but you probably want a nice patent IV in the antecubital space to give this med. You really want to be confident in your IV if you give calcium chloride peripherally. And you probably want to give it slowly so that if there is a big, you know, popping up of the skin around the vein, you could stop where you're at. We have had patients need amputations from calcium chloride injuries. You don't want to be that guy. But Leon states that the calcium, in whatever form you give it, usually doesn't work, and that's not going to be the solution. You try it, but don't really spend any time relying on that fixing the problem in a severe calcium channel blocker overdose. So at this point, I remember from my pharmacology days that there actually are quite a few different calcium channel blockers, and I asked Leon if it makes a difference which one the patient took.
No, well, there are basically three different types of major calcium channel blockers. There are the phenylalphaamines, mostly verapamil, and that verapamil significantly hits the heart as well as the circulation. So that's really the most frightening of them. There are the dihydropyridines like nifedipine. I can't recall seeing any significant nifedipine overdose. We have seen significant amlodipine overdoses, which is in the same class. And basically, I treat it the same. And then diltiazem is, and I can never remember the name of that group, but it's sort of in between. It does hit the heart, not as heavily as verapamil. But again, I treat them basically all the same.
All right, that last class for diltiazem is a benzothiazepine. No, I did not know that. I had to look that up afterwards. I certainly don't keep that stuff on the tip of my tongue. Now, why is this important? Why does it matter that there's these different classes? The reason it matters is that just because your patient took a calcium channel blocker overdose does not mean they'll be bradycardic. If they took the amlodipine or nifedipine as their overdose, they might actually be reflexively tachycardic. So don't assume your patient's lying and ignore their overdose just because they're not bradycardic. Most of them, like verapamil, diltiazem, will be bradycardic, but they don't necessarily have to be. Now, most of the calcium channel blocker treatment algorithms you see will often have glucagon in them. Glucagon is the mainstay for early treatment of beta blocker overdose. So next I ask Leon, does glucagon have a role? Should we be giving these patients glucagon?
One thing to realize about glucagon is that there's early literature that showed it was fairly effective in calcium channel blocker overdoses, but until I think the year was 1998, glucagon was made from basically ground up pork or beef pancreas, and so it might have had who knows how much insulin in it. So that might have confounded the results. Now it's a recombinant product.
So we've done our ABCs. We've given calcium without too much hope it's going to do anything, plus or minus on glucagon. The next question I asked Leon was, if the patient is bradycardic, is it worth even trying atropine? And he said, sure, give it a shot. You could do 0.5 or 1 milligram total, but it's not going to work in any significant overdose. And don't spend any time expecting this is going to be the solution. So everything up until this point should have taken at most a minute or two. They're on the monitors. At this point, if the patient is significantly hypotensive, Leon advocates starting pressers. You know, he might even start pressers the second they roll through the door if they were profoundly hypotensive. Leon's group uses dopamine. I'll tell you, as my listeners know by now, my preference is to use norepinephrine as my starting presser in almost all circumstances. I would say if the patient's significantly bradycardic, I might go for epinephrine. But really, I think this is all preference. There's not great evidence for any of this. The New England Journal article that just was published, I think I've spoken about this on previous podcasts, would tell you norepi might be better in cardiogenic shock. I don't know if that's really applicable to these cases. So I say if you like dopamine, if that's what your nurses are used to, go for it. But just start a presser early is what Leon is advocating. And then we come to the real heart of this podcast, which is the real new mainstay for treatment of calcium channel blocker overdoses. I'm not sure how many folks have done this, but the new treatment, the treatment you should be administering really early on, is high-dose insulin. So let's have Leon talk about that.
Okay, that's something that stemmed mostly from the work of Jeff Klein at the Carolinas. And they started to do animal work with this, as I recall, about 15 years ago. And then, while I was still publishing the hard copy of the Poison Review, so this would go back to the 1990s, there started to be case reports where this was used. And the reason for this is fairly interesting and gets to why calcium channel blockers are such a bad overdose. Calcium channel blockers do a number of things that are detrimental. One is they will decrease calcium uptake by myocardial cells and by the vascular smooth muscle. So they will decrease cardiac contractility and also cause vasodilatation. Now, when the body goes into, or when the heart experiences shock, it shifts from using free fatty acids primarily for energy to using carbohydrates. Unfortunately, another action of calcium channel blockers is that it decreases insulin release from the islet cells of the pancreas. Insulin release is a calcium-mediated process, and so calcium channel blockers will inhibit that. So you have the heart needing more carbohydrates, but not being able to get them because of decreased insulin release and also general insulin resistance. And that causes more shock and you get into a vicious cycle.
So you want to start high-dose insulin. How do you actually go about doing it?
Okay, one of the reasons that this has been a little slow getting started is that the dose of insulin is much higher than people are used to. And the starting dose is really one unit per kilogram as a bolus. And then a drip of, or an infusion of about half a unit or 0.5 units per kilogram per hour.
Now that's right, folks. Leon just said one unit per kilogram, 10 times higher than your normal dose. So on a 70 kilo guy, 70 units of insulin IV push and then 35 units as an infusion per hour. Wow. For people that haven't done that, that's kind of scary. I was just wondering, Leon, have you gotten pushback at any of the centers when you first introduced this as a therapy?
Yes. And we consult with hospitals all over the state, and we certainly still get pushback when using those doses. But there's been so much work with this and some studies, certainly many case reports, that at this point I think it's way beyond a sort of avant-garde therapy, and it's fairly well accepted now. And often we found, and certainly the literature reflects, that it is often quite effective when other therapies, pressors, etc., don't really work.
All right, so I start this up. How long before I see the effects? How long before I know it's really working?
Well, since it works through a metabolic process, there's some delay. But probably within 30 minutes or 30 to 45 minutes, you should see a response. That's another reason why you want to start it early, because it's not going to take effect immediately. So if you wait for severe hypotension, you're already behind the curve, and it may be difficult to catch up.
So that's interesting. So let's say I managed to stabilize the blood pressure with a reasonable dose of pressors. Should I still be starting high-dose insulin therapy?
Give a pressor such as norepinephrine or dopamine. If it works and the pressure comes up, you're going to want to give high-dose insulin and glucose anyway in an attempt to give a specific antidote and then wean the pressors. And if it doesn't work, you'd go to insulin anyway. So, you know, it certainly would be reasonable to give a pressor, but I wouldn't delay getting the insulin set up. I wouldn't wait and see if it worked before getting the insulin set up.
All right, so that makes sense. You're going to start the pressors, but you're going to give the high-dose insulin whether they work or not, because that's an actual antidote as opposed to a temporizing measure. So this high-dose insulin, is it fixed dose or is it titratable?
It can be titrated. Usually you don't need more than a unit per kilogram per hour, because at a certain point the insulin receptors get saturated. So, you know, even giving more isn't really going to, you're not going to get additional benefit.
Now you're giving these, you know, mega doses of insulin. What are you doing about the glucose during all this?
Our group recommends checking it every 15 or 20 minutes, at least for the first hour, until the glucose seems relatively stable. Then it can be checked every hour.
So now I asked Leon if he's giving dextrose with his high-dose insulin.
Okay, that's a little bit controversial. Many in our group would give, with the initial 1 gram per kilogram bolus of insulin, give an amp of D50. And some would also start a drip after that. If you're going to start a drip, the usual starting dose is somewhere around 10 grams an hour. So that would be 100 cc's of D10 per hour. Although there are certainly some in our group who do not recommend that because for a number of reasons. One is that usually it's not necessary. Certainly if you're dealing with a calcium channel blocker overdose, the glucose level is amazingly resistant to being lowered by insulin, so it's stable. In fact, we had a case where this was over a decade ago. One of our fellows dealing with a calcium channel blocker overdose in the ICU. I'm not sure if the order was mistaken or it was mistakenly set up, but instead of giving 100 units of insulin, gave 1,000 units of insulin. The glucose really didn't budge. The patient's hemodynamics improved and they did fine.
But Leon has another reason for not giving the dextrose initially.
And one other thing about that is another reason some people don't like to give the infusion is that there is some evidence that following the glucose level is important prognostically. For instance, if you give insulin and the glucose starts to come down, either immediately or after a period of time, that may be a sign that the patient's getting better and that things are improving, and you can start to think about discontinuing the insulin. The other thing is, getting back to even before therapy, if a patient comes in, there is some evidence that following the glucose level, if it's going up, is a poor prognostic sign that the calcium channel blocker toxicity is getting worse. Some people look at it almost as like following the QRS in a tricyclic overdose. Just one concern people have with high-dose insulin is hypokalemia. And we found, I think the literature shows that that's not really a problem. There are at least two considerations. One is that often patients with severe calcium channel blocker overdose are hypertensive, they're not perfusing well, and they're acidotic. So that by itself will raise potassium a little. And so the insulin might counteract that, but still not get into clinically significant low potassium levels. And of course, it won't cause a potassium depletion. It just moves potassium into the cell. And the other thing is, there's at least a theoretical reason to believe that some degree of hypokalemia may be beneficial, in that it prolongs the phase two of the myocardial action potential. And that's the phase in which calcium enters the cell. So by prolonging that, it might actually increase calcium entry into the cell. That's just theoretical at this point.
So when would you think about treating the potassium?
I don't think there's any firm evidence. I think some people would start to think about replacing it if it got below 2.5. Again, I don't know if that's a magic number. There's probably no magic number. But what we found, and I think what the literature reflects, is that when treating calcium channel blocker overdose with high-dose insulin, clinically significant hypokalemia is really does not appear to be a problem.
So are we just leaving this and sending the patient up to the ICU, or are we thinking about decreasing the insulin dosing if these patients are down in the ED for many, many hours?
Okay. Well, if the patient's stable on high dose, if they're also on pressors, you can start to wean the pressor. And then if they're off that and the hemodynamics are stable, at that point you can think about decreasing or discontinuing the insulin. And certainly if the glucose is going down, you'd want to at least cut it back.
Now, there are no firm recommendations on how to decrease this insulin infusion, but Leon said, you know, thinking about maybe 5 to 10 unit decrease per hour and see how the patient does with it would probably be acceptable. Now, Leon, let's say you thought this was a calcium channel blocker overdose, and turns out you're wrong. Is this high-dose insulin going to cause problems if you gave it in a shock state that turned out not to be calcium channel blocker overdose?
Yes. I mean, if you're not dealing with a calcium channel blocker overdose, certainly the high-dose insulin could saturate the insulin receptors and cause a significant decrease in glucose. That with a couple of things that could be fixed, and if the situation is unclear, one thing to consider is giving a test dose of insulin, say 10 units, and seeing what happens to the glucose. If the glucose doesn't move or if it continues to go up, that's certainly very persuasive evidence that you're in fact dealing with a calcium channel blocker overdose.
All right, so that's a great tip. If you're unsure if it's a calcium channel blocker overdose, consider giving a test dose first. If the insulin sharply decreases after 10 units of insulin, probably not a calcium channel blocker overdose. And just for the record, insulin probably has a beneficial effect in any shock state. It's an anti-inflammatory on the heart. It probably has inotropic effects, and people are studying it for other shock states besides calcium channel blocker overdose. So it wouldn't be the worst thing in the world to give it a shot if you're unsure. Now, a lot of the protocols, if there is bradycardia, also recommend things like milrinone, the phosphodiesterase inhibitors.
People talk about the phosphodiesterase 3 inhibitors like milrinone and amrinone, and they do appear at some place on many of the calcium channel blocker overdose algorithms. As far as I'm aware, that goes back to only one study, and I'm not aware of any good evidence that they're effective, and they also have a theoretical downside of milrinone and amrinone are vasodilators, so that might increase the hypertension. So in general, our group doesn't use that. Let me add one other thing for calcium channel blockers, and again, this is very preliminary, and so I'm not sure it's ready for prime time yet. But again, if all else is failing, there is animal evidence, and I think one case report that appeared in Resuscitation last year where a severe calcium channel overdose, specifically verapamil overdose, seem to improve on lipid emulsion therapy. I think it's 100 cc's of the 20% intralipid over 15 minutes or 30 minutes.
Now, Leon, most of the aggressive protocols for CCB overdose eventually get down to things like aortic balloon pump, ECMO, cardiac bypass. What are your thoughts on that?
There certainly have been cases where that's been used successfully. And it certainly, if all else is failing, I'd consider it obviously logistically, it may be very difficult to set up. But certainly that's an option if nothing else is working.
So at this point, we realized we haven't talked about the favorite therapy of toxicology, or perhaps the favorite therapy to debate about, which is charcoal, gastric lavage, whole bowel irrigation. So let's hear from Leon on that one.
Interesting question. I think if the patient comes in and they're stable, their mental status is okay, they're not significantly hypotensive, they have bowel sounds, it would make sense to give one dose of activated charcoal. But as with all uses of charcoal, whether that's effective or not or beneficial has really not been proven. Sometimes what's recommended or what people do is whole bowel irrigation, especially if it's a sustained release product, and I'd definitely advise against that. Several reasons. One is that it's never been proven to be effective, but it has significant downsides, and including aspiration. Also, if the patient looks stable, if it's a significant calcium channel blocker overdose, they can become unstable, significantly hypotensive relatively quickly. And at that point, you could end up with a whole lot of high molecular weight polyethylene glycol in a gut that's not being perfused. And I don't think that's a good idea.
Wow, that was just incredible. So to sum up, severe calcium channel blocker overdose, ABCs, big bore IVs, O2, monitor. Tricalcium, not going to work. Start them on pressors if their blood pressure is low. I like norepi, dopamine's probably fine. Epi, if they're bradycardic, may be an option. But as you're starting your pressors, or if the patient's not hypotensive, but they're showing signs of toxicity, you're going to start high-dose insulin. And that is 1 unit per kilogram push, and then half a unit titratable up to 1 unit per kilogram per hour. Infusion, you don't necessarily have to give dextrose, but check your sugar frequently. Hypokalemia may be a problem, but probably not in these calcium channel blocker overdose patients, and you don't really have to worry about it until it gets below about 2.5. Lipid emulsion might have a role. Leon recommends giving charcoal, but not doing things like whole bowel irrigation or gastric lavage. And I think we'll stop there. You're going to be hearing more from Leon in future podcasts. Please, please go check out the Poison Review. Really fantastic stuff. These interview podcasts are hard, but I will be having more in the future because I think it's great to reach out to other folks in the EM podcast and blog world. And so, Leon, I can't thank you enough.
Okay, well, thank you. This was fun.
And to my listeners, as always, thank you for listening. If you enjoy the MCRIT podcast and you haven't already, do me a big favor. Go to iTunes and give us a 5-star review. And if you have another couple seconds, just write a little something. And it really, really does good things for the podcast. I'd really appreciate it. And if you don't like it, don't go to iTunes and give us less than a 5-star review. Send me an email, and whatever is bothering you, I will endeavor to fix. All right, that's all for now. Have a great week. Bye-bye.